Okay. Again, we are going to be discussing these attributes for the younger women. And I just want to state once again what we had mentioned in previous studies, the importance of the older women to teach the younger women. And there are certain impediments to such teaching being done, or can be. I'm not saying that there necessarily are, but there can be. One is that the younger women aren't interested in hearing. I remember talking to Sister Foster Tippy a number of years ago, and she kind of remarked of her willingness to teach. And there are many who have been taught by her, by influence, or also classes that she has had in her home and different things. But she said it's seldom that anyone asks her for advice. Now, it's not saying that none of the individuals here did or have. But that's a wealth of knowledge that Tippy has and remains. I mean, she's, I think, 95 now, and her memory's not very good, but she's sharp enough in mind to give advice, and so she's still an available resource. And I think the older women of the congregation can be helpful to the younger ladies, but there are those two things. Number one, the younger ladies often don't ask. And number two, the older women sometimes are a bit reticent. They're unwilling to press by giving advice that is not offered or that is not requested. And so what I want to note, first of all, is that there is a tremendous amount of wisdom that older women have to offer with regard to the specific things that are mentioned in verses 4 and 5, that the young women are to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. And what we're talking about is not only an understanding of biblical principles, but the discretion and discernment that comes through experience. And that's extremely important. That because they have lived that life, because they have been involved in those two primary relationships of a wife and a mother, that there are practical pieces of advice that they have to offer. And so keep that in mind, younger ladies, that those resources are available. But secondly, I want to, just before we go on into discussing what the younger women are to learn, is that these... In verse 3, the responsibility is given to the older woman to be a teacher of good things. Now, this may be in part through influence, letting our light shine before men that they may see our good works and glorify God. Some are more capable with regard to actually giving instruction in a class setting than others, those kinds of things. But that doesn't absolve you of a responsibility to be a teacher. We could say the same. Elders, for example, are the apt to teach, and some men are qualified because they don't have that aptitude or that ability to the extent that others may have. But that doesn't change the fact that we're given the responsibility to share the gospel message with those who are lost. Some women may not be comfortable standing in front of a class of young women and actually teaching, but the ability to go and to give some one-on-one advice or to show through the life that you live these kinds of examples, those are responsibilities that women have, older women have, to teach the younger women. And it's just not acceptable to say, as a Christian, because I'm not real good at teaching or talking, that I'm not going to share the gospel message with my family, or I'm not going to share the gospel message with my friends because I don't think I'd really do a good job, so I'm just not going to do that. That's what the one talent man does. And likewise, the same thing can be said with regard to an older woman. It's not my place, or I'm just not real comfortable doing that, and so I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. Well, that's the one talent woman in that particular case, we could say, and is something that would not please God. So there needs to be that activity, that effort on the part of those who are older women. And again, I do understand sometimes that those kinds of things may not be well received, but in those situations or circumstances, if that's the case, the onus would fall upon the younger woman who's not receptive to it rather than the older woman for making that effort to give that advice and to share those needful things.
Yes. Well, I think too, and I believe it's in this verse, that we have a responsibility just by our behavior. And that is one way that even if you can't talk to somebody, people many times make comments about someone. She's a very, gracious person, or she's always willing to help, or things like that. And that should be obvious to other people, and not because we want to show off, but because we do it.
Well, those things, I think, are most strongly taught with regard to love of husband, love of children, kindness, gentleness, a gentle and quiet spirit, hospitality, graciousness, those kinds of things that we, I think, universally extol and indicate are the kinds of attributes that should be present in any woman who is a Christian. Those things are best taught through influence. But again, let me just rephrase this just a little bit so that you'll kind of understand what I'm saying. If you see a younger woman who is doing something that is, number one, sinful, okay, certainly we've got that responsibility, those who are spiritual, restore such a one. But it could sometimes be best, depending upon what the sin is or the lack is, that it could be best addressed by an older woman taking her aside and with gentleness correcting. But secondly, if you see someone struggling, say a young mother who's just having a hard time getting it together, maybe she doesn't have help from her husband, maybe she just has so many kids that it makes it difficult, whatever the case may be, or maybe she's having to work. There are a lot of things that happen in our society today that make it difficult for her to be the kind of mother or the kind of wife that she really needs to be. And if that is the case, without necessarily her asking for advice, you could go to her and say just something simple like, I know how you're feeling, and I felt the same way when I was your age or in this particular time in my life, and I found that doing this, this, and this was helpful. Okay, so you've taught something. You've given some advice. You've given some applications that might be helpful as far as a biblical principle that she might have never thought of. And so you can say, I'm being a good influence and that is sufficient. But again, with these specific things, they're supposed to teach not that you love your husband, but how to love your husband. I mean, if we were to say that the older women are teaching the younger women to love their husbands, you ever go to any younger woman in this congregation and say, do you love your husband? They'll tell you they do. Okay, but there's something that has to be taught about loving your husband. To love has reference to having affection for, but affection is shown. I know that the words are not agape, but we do use that as an example. If I'm going to love someone, I'm going to seek their welfare. I'm going to try to do for them. And there are ways that can be accomplished with regard to husbands and children that the younger women may not have been taught. It may be, there are a lot of younger women who become Christians and didn't have the benefit of being raised by godly mothers. And so it may be something they're ignorant of. It may be something that just the practical application thereof is not fully understood. And so good can come as a result of it. So what I'm asking the older women to do is to be mindful, again, the importance of influence, but to be mindful of the younger women that you come into contact with in the church, that there may be some struggles or some need on that part that you can help with. And just have that mindset to be one who helps. Okay? All right, so now getting into the actual attributes that are mentioned in. Younger women are to be. And so by the way, that word younger women is the Greek word neoteros. And neo means new. I think we recognize that from a lot of different applications in the English language. And it has a very broad application. It actually can mean recently born and young or youthful. So we're talking about, in this case, of course, younger women to love their husbands would certainly be applicable to young married women. But again, if you wait until a young woman is actually married to teach her to love her husband, maybe you're too late there. And so I want us to kind of broaden this because we've got, If I mention the girls, I'll forget someone, so I don't want to do that. We've got some young ladies from children, small children all the way up to middle school, who are members of our congregation that need to be learning these things right away and right now and be trained up in that direction, and we can give them a lot of help in that regard. And the older women can. But this idea is first of all, to be sober. Now that idea of sobriety is something that we have already mentioned with regard to the older men in verse 2 of the text, to be sober. So noting what that one is, the Greek word nephalios, it means temperate, and it is certainly inclusive of being abstinent with regard to wine, but it is something that's more impactful of it. You've heard of the temperance movement, which was for a period of time successful in getting alcohol declared illegal in the United States. The temperance movement then, since it was aligned with the concept of sobriety, that is, not drinking at all, abstinence, that when you hear the word temperate or sober in our day and time, the idea is always with regard to drink, or perhaps even some kind of illicit drug or something like that. We're to be in control of our bodies, our control of our minds, and getting drunk or getting high are things that take away from that. But having said that, this is a general broad word that is inclusive of all the desires and passions that we might have, that our body is to be well regulated. We are to be in control of ourselves. And so when we talk about passions and we talk about desires, typically we refer to those who are young, especially with regard to sexual passions, with regard to the energy of youth, with regard to lack of training with regard to young people. You talk about old people's sins and young people's sins, and that's stereotypical, certainly. But there are things that young people do that get them into trouble that I might not would do, not because I'm not tempted, but because it's just too much trouble and I don't have energy to. I'm just not interested anymore. So we recognize different stages of our life, which is actually somewhat being talked about here. So when we talk about sobriety and being in control, an old man certainly needs it, but the problems of sobriety and temperance, well, those are things that are certainly and legitimately a focus for young people, because that's not characteristic of youth. And so sobriety is something that is extremely important. Okay. Now, the next... does anybody have any questions about this?
This has the footnote of that, and it's responsible.
Well, you know, those are all synonymous. I mean, that idea of how are you acting? Do you act with sobriety, act responsibly, all that? Yeah, in control of yourself. Anybody else? So, yes, Dave.
You know, the last phrase of life, I don't know if that's right now, where it says that the word of God be not blasphemed. Of course, that not only applies to the old women, that applies to all members of the church. From the youth, adults, middle-aged, and older. How many times have you seen the church be blessing the actions of a member of the church, you know? And so we've got to be careful, and that applies to everybody, you know? And you know what I'm saying?
Sir. Yeah, and we're going to actually, in the next slide, that's the second point. So we'll get to that in a moment. We've actually, I'm jumping all over the place, but we're not there yet. But we will talk about that a little bit more, so we'll cover that well. Okay, so the first of those two questions, by the way, is explain the term love in chapter 2 and verse 4. So I want to do that, first of all, kind of. We'll skip over that slide because we're going to be talking about it when we're talking about these responsibilities. The idea of love, we mentioned that it's not agape love in this particular text. The word love, their husbands, is philandros. And the love their children is philotechnos. So the idea is the root word Philadelphia, phileo, The idea of brotherly love. Philadelphia is phila love, and Delphi, which has reference to brothers. So what it's saying is that whatever this particular attribute is, who is it directed toward? So if it's Philadelphos, it's directed toward your brother, and specifically your brother in Christ, and that word is used. If it's Philandros, it is love of man. Andros is the word for man. But that word is commonly used, and context indicates in this particular passage that has reference to love for husband. Love of children, technos, philotechnos, would be your children under consideration. Of course, we should love all children, I know, but this is talking about the domestic situation or circumstance. So the key there is that idea of what does phileo indicate with regard to responsibility. When we talk about agape, we've mentioned this, that it's not necessarily something that involves affection. When husbands are told to love their wives in Ephesians chapter 5, while a husband is to love his wife, have affection for his wife, the word agape, that higher expression of love, is given there because of his position as the one who's head of the home. He has the responsibility to express love by doing what is best for her, not being selfish, doing what he wants to do, but rather being considerate of her so that what her needs are will be met, and what is best for her spiritual welfare will be accomplished, because the husband is aware of that and striving to accomplish that. So the agape love that is referred to in Ephesians 5 for the husband isn't necessarily referring to affection, though we recognize that that should be present. Here, it is specifically referring to the fact that a woman is to be affectionate toward her husband. Now, it's not limited to that concept of merely affection. It's comprehensive with regard to her treatment of her husband. But this idea of deference, this idea of acting submissively, doing for, those kinds of things are all a part of that. Paying attention to her husband, showing affection for her husband, making her husband happy. That's certainly inclusive of it. Now, I don't want to talk much about it, but I do want to note the intimacy of the marriage relationship, and as a part of this affection is the sexual component in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 3 of the text. And in that context, the man does not have ownership of his own body, but his wife, the wife, her own body, but the husband, and that they should not withdraw or abstain from the affection that is due the other. Affection that is due, that's the phrase that the Apostle Paul used in 1 Corinthians 7, which, by the way, is in the hook-up culture, is what it's called, of our day, where people merely date to engage in recreational sexual activity. That misses the boat so much, and we understand that. The marriage bed is undefiled, whoremongers and adulterers God will judge, as Hebrews 13 says. But the fact that the Apostle Paul refers to the sexual relationship, indicating this idea of affection, the closeness, the intimacy of that relationship, the sexual relationship, is right only in the marriage relationship, because it is something that is born out of philandros and the equivalent with regard to the husband loving his wife. And so that's a very important part of that. So it's a comprehensive idea. It is supporting the husband in every worthy endeavor to express that affection to bring about marital happiness. And it's twofold, the responsibility, but the responsibility is especially important with regard to the younger women because of the domestic responsibilities that they hold in the home. And that's why it's emphasized by the Apostle Paul on this particular occasion. I know it's not politically correct to make such distinctions, to make such emphasis without emphasizing the other, but Paul does it often. And that's the reason for it is because men and women are different, and the responsibilities of men are different from the responsibilities of women, and the tendency for sin on the part of the woman comes in not fulfilling these responsibilities that are, he delineates in this particular passage. And so philandros is the love of husband. Let's go. The love of children. It's an obvious addition to this particular thing. Philotechnos, affection for children. Now, of course, we love our children. And in fact, I think sometimes in our society, there is a distortion to the extreme with regard to love of children, where children are pandered to, where the value of children is elevated to the point to where they become spoiled. And you hear about that in our society. In olden times, children should be seen and not heard. But in our day and time, children are the focus of everything. And as a result of that, the concept of discipline and nurture and training and a child understanding their place and the submissive concepts are not being explained appropriately. Having said that, this particular admonition is you need to love your children. So that indicates that it is possible for a mother not to love her children, not to show affection. And there are warnings concerning immorality in our society or in previous societies to where women could be without natural affection. It's a natural thing, we understand it, to love your children. Which is one of the things that is so amazing to me about, especially recently, the abortion question in our society, because this is the killing of unborn children. And you know, I know how my wife felt about our four children before they were born. I know the tenderness that she felt toward them. I know how she took care of herself, how she looked forward to it, the birth of the children, the joy that came when they were born and they were born healthy, all of those kinds of things. That natural affection was there from the moment that she conceived and was aware of the conception. This is something that is extremely important to her. You've got people now, women who are as a part of this movement where there is the justification for abortion. No longer is it supposed to be safe, rare, and legal. Or legal, safe, and rare. I think it's the way legal, safe, and rare is the way they put it. They aren't saying that now. And there are women who are coming out and proudly sharing their experiences of their abortions. As if this is a badge of honor for them. And that's without natural affection. That's not loving your children. That's the most hateful thing that can be done. But the idea that a woman has the right to choose to terminate a pregnancy because it's going to be something that is something she doesn't desire, something that would be inconvenient for her, something that's not good for her at this point in time in her life. I heard it expressed one time just recently, perhaps the best way. What the abortion advocates are saying is that you're taking away the reproductive rights of women, and that's not so. We're not taking away reproductive rights. A woman can choose whether she wants to reproduce or not reproduce. Every woman has that right. But once you have already reproduced, now we want to protect the life of that child. So we're taking away the right for a woman to kill her child, is what we're saying. And in our day and time, you have so many to express it. I understand some do it out of ignorance. There was one lady on a Fox News, or maybe they just reported it, but she was giving an interview. And she said when that woman conceives, that is not a child. That's just a lump of tissue. Is what she said. And that's just not so. And I think scientifically we can establish that. The Bible certainly advocates for the unborn child as being a child. But having said that, that lack of natural affection is something that is characteristic of our society. So, again, when the younger women are being taught by the older women, it is to be affectionate toward your child, to take care of your child, to have that tenderness. And, again, it is something that can be taught. And so it's natural. My wife, it was a natural thing for her. But how do you do it? How do you comfort your child? How do you express that affection? How do you relieve suffering or discomfort? How do you handle the situation? With my daughter, I mentioned, I think it's in the bulletin, my son-in-law, Jared, lost his grandfather earlier in the week. And they had a very quick funeral. they had the funeral on Friday. I think he passed away Wednesday, and they had the funeral on Friday because that's what he wanted. But as a result of that, my daughter was calling for advice as to how to deal with the loss of this great-grandfather, Sawyer. What do I say to Sawyer? She's going to ask, this man was not a Christian. She's going to ask about heaven. She's going to ask if he's going to heaven. She's going to ask about why isn't he coming back? All of those kinds of things. And she just didn't know how to handle it. Didn't know how to approach it. And you know, that's something Debbie could have told her and helped her with. I was the first to see it, so I wrote some suggestions to her as to how to handle it. But, you know, she loves her child. She doesn't want her child to hurt. She wants her child to maybe use this as a teaching or to have an opportunity to be taught. Should she go to the funeral? Should she see the body? What will that do to a three-year-old? No, she didn't know. And so some instructions were given. Some advice was given. And it very much helped her. So, oh, good. Now I have something, some guidelines to go by. She can make her own decision out of how she handles it. But I've given her some information as to how to. So the need to teach them how to love their husband and their children is a big part of this. All right. Okay, so love of husband, love of children. Anybody want to add anything to that? I must have covered that very well. Okay, the next one is discreet. The word discreet is from the Greek word sophron, and it means of a sound mind, sane in one's senses, and also curbing one's desires and impulses, self-controlled or temperate. So when we hear discretion and being discreet, we think of something a little bit different. This carries with it a little bit more of an idea of the idea of temperance. So it goes hand in hand with the concept of sobriety. But if you think about it, when we use the word discreet, what we mean is that there's a particular thing that's happening. And let's say a woman is she's been given some kind of an honor, some kind of an award or something. And just try to get it away from some of the things we typically talk about so that you can see what I'm saying. So in this particular case, she has received this honor, so what's she going to do? She's going to jump up and down, look at me, I'm important, I've done a great job, and basically emote to the point of where she is perhaps number one annoying, but acting in an untoward manner because she's not controlling herself in this regard. A woman who has discretion, who is discreet, using the term in this way, would be very quiet and humble and perhaps self-deprecating and dismissive of those kinds of things. She's a discreet person. She doesn't want to bring attention to herself. Well, she might want to bring attention to herself. She might want to say, look at me, look what happened with me, look what good I did. But because she is able to curb that desire and that impulse, she acts in a more polite way, one that is more conducive to a godly, gentle, and quiet spirit. So that's where the concept of discretion or discreet comes in that word. We use perhaps a little bit less of a powerful definition when we use the word discretion or discreet in our day than what is found in this particular term. The idea of temperance is involved in it as well. All right? Questions, comments about discreet? Next one, then, is the word chaste. The word chaste from the Greek word hagnos means exciting, reverence, venerable, sacred, pure from carnality, chaste or modest. So the idea of a reverent and pure individual who is not carnal, the idea of chastity. Again, we use that term, and I think pretty properly with regard to this definition. What a woman who is chaste does is always consider how her conduct will be perceived. She wants to be respectful always. Specifically with regard to her sexual conduct, she wants to be perceived as one who is holy, one who is modest, one who is pure. And, you know, again, used the changing of times. It used to be that wedding dresses were white because that was an indication of purity. That is, that she was virginal, and so the white was symbolic of that. Well, in our day and time, that's atypical rather than typical. And I'm not saying that it should change, or that you know, she ought to wear a scarlet A when she gets married. But the point is that now it's just tradition. It's not really symbolic of what it once was. So the idea of chastity with regard to young women is especially important. Again, we're training them when they're young, before they get married. So the idea of chastity and purity is important there. Again, I would refer to the text, Hebrews 13, that the marriage bed is undefiled, but fornicators, God will judge. Adulterers, God will judge. But also, the idea of purity on the part of the young woman with regard to her behavior towards those who are not her husband, if she is married. And that's extremely important. With regard to dress, especially, women who had the idea in our day and time that I should be able to dress the way that I want, and if someone lusts after me or is lecherous or lewd in their manner or demeanor, it's on them, not on me. That's, again, it's an aspect of our society. It's not politically correct today to say that women have a responsibility to present themselves and that they have a causal impact with regard to a man's sin if they do not present themselves in a modest way. How dare you say that I'm responsible for your lust? Well, I'm not saying that. The man is responsible for his own lust. He'll be judged by his own lust. But if you dress in such a way to contribute to that lust, then God will hold you accountable for contributing to that lust. That's what lasciviousness is. And chastity is the opposite of that. And women need to be aware of that. And when we talk about, let's say, women who do work, we talk about the idea of office romances and adulterous affairs, those kinds of things. I'll just give you an example from my past. Anecdotally, there was a deacon in the church in Crescent Park who had an affair with another deacon's wife. Destroyed two marriages right there. And there was a familiarity that was present between those couples. They were good friends, but that familiarity led to interactions between just the two of them that led to an affair. And one who is chaste and modest and pure and reverent is going to, and maybe discreet, is going to curb those impulses and not act in such a way as to where a man would ever be willing to say, "Hey, are you interested?" And of course, that's where those kinds of things start. Again, not saying that the woman is any more responsible for those things than the man is in those situations, but she does have that special responsibility to be chaste. So the word chastity has reference, or chaste has reference to that.
And this is one of those places where we do need to keep in mind that agape love. If we have agape love for our brethren, this was brought to my mind early on, that would you want to be responsible, talking to me as a young lady, for tempting a married man by the way that you're dressing, you know, in your own yard, whatever. But would you want to be responsible for that? And it made me think about it in a different way. And I thought, no, I wouldn't. And so it made me think about myself. How would I want to, you know, to handle that? So it was very good advice at the time.
I have read a number of articles and come across a number of situations where different churches had problems. And where there were any men, but specifically in the one I'm thinking of, younger men were going to the elders and saying, "We got a problem. What's the problem?" Said, "Well, I'm having difficulty serving the Lord's Supper." So, what do you mean serving the Lord's Supper? Because that's something where our mind is on the remembrance of the the body and blood of Christ in the sacrifice, and we do this as a form of communion. It's a very grave situation. Well, is they're serving the supper because of them standing and the woman sitting, and because of the fashions of the day, there was too much exposure. It was they didn't want to notice it. They didn't want to dwell on it. They didn't want to be guilty of lascivious thoughts whenever they're serving it, but they were struggling because some of the young women in the congregation were not dressing appropriately. And so again, and do remember that men are very different from women with regard to what sexually attracts and those kinds of things. And I think that's something that we see as well. So it is something that's important for women to be aware of always. In every circumstance. All right, anybody else? All right, then we get to the next one, which is to be homemakers. Oh me, homemakers. Women are to actually be homemakers. That's, again, a politically incorrect thing. The word actually means one who cares for the house, works at home, the keeper of the house, keeping at home, and taking care of household affairs. I'm getting all these definitions from Thayer. So that's what the word means. A very simple thing, that the primary responsibility. And again, I tell you something. I am impressed with younger men than I in generations. A part of this equal rights movement and a part of the idea that sometimes the people, women have to work because of economic necessity. There has been a change in how that is handled in the home somewhere, where the young men are helping, and they're expressing agape love for their wife and doing that. And you know, Josh does so much better job of that than I ever did with regard to washing and dishwashing. And now Rachel's saying, "No, he doesn't," but he does. She recognizes it. But he may not do as good a job as she wants him to do, but he does so much better than what I did at that age, and still do to that extent. And I'm better than my father was in regard to that. And I'm absolutely convinced that Jeremiah's going to do a good job as well in that regard. But having said that, there is a circumstance. It's a duty that has been given to the woman in the home that cannot be abdicated. It doesn't matter what the relationship is in your particular marriage. It doesn't matter whether you work for a living or whatever. There is a responsibility. And as a part of that definition, definition 1A, the watch or keeper of the house. This word is a word that is used with regard to those who are servants who are in charge of a domestic situation or a home as well. It depends upon the circumstances of the situation. You kind of understand that. So I'm in charge of, or it's my primary responsibility. I'm the one that's going to be held accountable if this is not accomplished as it is supposed to be accomplished. And that's the responsibility that the woman has, and she has to recognize and understand. And as a big part of that, I think, although we probably have already discussed it with regard to loving children, it doesn't just have to do with vacuuming and washing the dishes and washing the clothes and picking up. It has to do with the fact that there is a responsibility and duty with regard to not only the household affairs, but the home. And that was inclusive, certainly, of the love of the husband and the love of the children, and making sure that you are expressing your affection in these domestic ways. All right. Did I do that with enough candor but tact? Anybody have anything you want to add to that? All right. Then we have two others, and then we'll get to the not to be blasphemed next week. So good, being good. Well, what does that mean? Of good constitution or nature, useful, salutary. Good, pleasant, agreeable, joyful, happy. Good person. That's a good person. People like to be around you. You give happiness to people. There's nothing that is toxic about you. A dripping faucet and a contentious woman. That's what the writer of Proverbs says. And so that idea is found in the concept of good. And then finally, obedience. And that's something we've discussed over and over and over again. Hupotasso, obedient to the husband. And that word, obedient, means to arrange under, to subordinate, to subject, put in subjection, to subject one's self, or obey. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is that is typically attributed by our culture as an indication of inferiority. If a woman is considering herself inferior, or the man is considering himself superior because of the position of subjection. Galatians 3:28 tells us there is neither Jew nor Greek, bond or free, male nor female. We're all one in Christ Jesus. This has absolutely nothing to do with the value of the person. It has to do with the hierarchy of the responsibility and the hierarchy of the relationship. If I have a boss and I'm an employee, I am no less a person, no less important, no less significant, no less valuable than he is. But I am in subjection to him because he is my boss. And that's what this idea is indicating. A hierarchy in relationship that I think we generally understand, but is badly misunderstood in our world today.
Is that like, I'm trying to get this in my mind. We pretty much understand of being in a home, mother and a father and children. We understand that, basically speaking, the father is the head of the household. Even in our society today, that's understood. We show them respect. We show them obedience as long as we're living in their household. But when that changes and you move with a husband, that should be, you understand that they no longer have that.
Right.
Say, oh, no, it's transferred. You're still your own person, but you owe that responsibility and respect to the husband instead of the father.
Yeah, and that's what Jesus talked about it as well, but what Genesis kind of indicates, that man leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife. You're establishing a new home, a new relationship that is that changes the relationship that a woman has with her parents. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention. We'll talk about that last phrase of the Word of God, be not blasphemed, and then get into a discussion of the young men. And we're going to go real quickly over that. No.